This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, August 14th, 2014. I'm Caleb Brown. Americans are seeing images this week of the realities of police militarization. The protests in Ferguson, Missouri follow the killing of an unarmed teenager by police. Walter Olson, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, evaluates the police response and the federal government's involvement in providing military-grade weapons to local police. What we're seeing out of Ferguson, Missouri is shocking. It doesn't look like the United States.
And people see it and they wonder, why are armored vehicles going through a town just outside St. Louis? Why are police dressed in camouflage when this is not the desert? This is a landscape of convenience stores and gas stations. Why the immediately classic photo of a protester, I think, waving a sign with the telltale red dot of a laser pointer on his or her chest, from a sharpshooter just having fun, I guess, or thinking of aiming at them. Now, first thing I ever heard about gun safety was don't point a gun at someone unless you would be willing to pull the trigger and shoot them. And yet everyone saw from Ferguson the police, including ones mounted on top of vehicles, aiming at the people who were just protesting. Now, there's so much to unpack there. There's so many different police mistakes in the Michael Brown case, but the militarization is the background, and it is something that's not just Ferguson. It's not just a relatively poor inner suburb. It is across the country. It is rural counties that have hardly any crime. It is affluent towns like Redwood City, California, filled with Silicon Valley workers. All these police departments are arming themselves with what would be seen normally as warlike materials and equipment. And so this has brought it on to the front pages, but we've been waiting for something like this to happen, because with all that military gear out there, it was inevitable that they'd start using it.
A whole lot of this is being driven by the federal government.
A huge amount is being driven by the federal government. And again, people don't realize that until they begin looking at the programs. Most of them started or ramped up after 9/11, in which billions and billions of dollars of military-grade equipment have been dropped on America's local police forces. Now, you have just in one program, the military surplus program from the Pentagon, last year alone, $449 million worth of surplus military equipment was presented to local police forces. And that's just one program. Homeland Security has its own completely separate and extremely large grant program, which helps them buy new equipment as opposed to surplus used equipment. And there are yet others. Stimulus paid for some of it. And so what you get is a sudden set of new incentives where there seems to be all this free stuff out there. Now, it's interesting to note what kind of free stuff it is, because they don't usually set up federal programs to simply replace things you were going to spend money on anyway. So, you know, every police force has all of these routine expenditures on things they've always spent money on. That's not what the federal government wants to pay for. It wants to pay for something that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. And what better for something you wouldn't have gotten otherwise than a flashy toy or something that the congressman can point to, because it's a helicopter. People wonder what kind of gear, and it includes everything from the now famous armored vehicles, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these armored vehicles have been given out lately. They are mine-resistant armored vehicles, and I have yet to hear of a single instance in which landmines were a threat to an American urban police force, which are also, some people may be relieved to hear, protective against radiation. Again, I have not heard of a radiation threat in a typical American police scene. And So you've got these vehicles, you've got rifle sights for sharpshooting, you've got body armor, you've got silencers. I'm still trying to figure out what legitimate reason a local police force would have to get silencers. And you've got grenade launchers. Now, when you think of a police department using grenade launchers, the only instance I can think of where that might have come into play was when the Philadelphia police force took down an entire city block when the MOVE people were barricaded. But I can't think of an instance where grenade launchers would be on hand where people feel good about, oh, yes, that's just what we wanted the local police force to do. Certainly, situations that tend to get talked of on the floor of Congress when people are passing these subsidy programs, overwhelmingly, it's a combination of Homeland Security. What would we do if there were a terrorist incident in Cedar Rapids and school shootings? After all, school shootings are terrible. Shouldn't they have some way? Now, lack of police weaponry has not typically been the problem in bringing a school shooting to an end. There isn't a reason to think that it would make a whole lot of difference to have different uniforms for the cops or different sorts of body armor, but these are the things that push people's buttons, and we know, of course, that the terrorist threat has not panned out in the way that it was widely predicted to, and you'd think that that would lead to second thoughts about the program. Why are we still shipping huge amounts of armament as if there were about to be Beslan-like takeovers of buildings with hundreds of people in them, like the Moscow Theater or something? That doesn't happen. So presumably we can save ourselves the money, and of course it's more than just a money cost, of arming ourselves as if they did happen.
There is this other element specifically with respect to Ferguson, but it is a problem elsewhere, which is reporters who are merely attempting to document what's going on are either arrested or, in the case of some Al Jazeera America journalists, hit with tear gas and then have their equipment disassembled when they run away.
It has been a real education for people how the press has been treated so shabbily in Ferguson. Nearly everyone realizes that if they're willing to do this to the press, then they're probably not afraid to do that to some obscure citizen when no one is looking. But you've had reporters for the Huffington Post and Washington Post arrested. You've had the alderman who was the leading Twitter source of information for people, an alderman from St. Louis. He was arrested and eventually released. And their reasons, when they give the reasons at all, they are somewhat puzzling reasons, like the police felt that this area should be cleared. Well, okay, that explains the police's thinking, but it doesn't necessarily explain the legality of why were so many commands seemingly issued to stop filming. There has been some court testing of what is believed to be the right to film, but even without having to go to court, you can think of what the First Amendment is for and the tremendous importance on a practical level of being able to have citizens filming what are often going to be tremendously important news events with long-term impact if as the police seem to want, not just in Ferguson, but in many other situations around the country, if the police believe that they can simply order people to stop filming, we will have no record of what they do.
There is sort of a disconnect here between keeping the peace and maintaining total control over a specific geographic area. And that seems to have been that line seems to have been completely erased.
It is more of a military concept that you must completely control an area and pacify it. And it is more of a traditional policing concept that you identify what risks there are and let life go back to normal as much as possible while you're chasing the bad guys, as opposed to controlling the territory. And So much of the Ferguson outrage has been from these clumsy, at best, and you could say worse things, crowd control techniques, whether it be telling people that they may not legally walk on the streets, or whether it's lobbing tear gas into their front yards. Dramatic confrontations in which residents of Ferguson said, when asked to disperse, I'm in my front yard. This is my own property. I live here. And the answer they got was tear gas, specifically aimed at them. That's called to mind for a lot of people, military tactics. And part of the irony here is that if you talk to actual military people who've been in Iraq and other war zones recently, I hear again and again variations on the theme of, I was in a war zone and they were not armed anywhere nearly that heavily and they treated people with more respect. If you are an actual army of occupation, the irony is you will probably be given very professional training, and you will probably be told to calm things down so that the civilians can trust and like you if possible. This is an issue where libertarians took the lead and have been at the forefront for many years. Radley Balko is very well known for the excellent book Rise of the Warrior Cop that he published a couple of years ago, but Cato Institute has repeatedly covered it. Reason Magazine has repeatedly covered it. And this is important now because we have a moment with Senator Rand Paul speaking out, with Representative Justin Amash speaking out. We have a moment where it's possible to cross ideological lines and get people listening to each other in a way that they usually tend to screen each other out. There is a real moment of opportunity here with what's happened in Ferguson to bring people together in the resolution that we can't go on with an ever more military police. We have to turn back.
Walter Olson is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Read more of his work at cato.org.